Chapter 7. Approved, transmitted. Well, said Granger, here we are. Sometimes a statement of the bloody obvious was the only appropriate way forward, as if to give life ceremonious permission to proceed. Are you okay? She asked. Yes, he said, swaying in his seat. The dizziness he'd felt back at the base had come over him again. I'm probably overexcited. It's my first time, after all. She gave him a look he recognized very well. A look he'd seen on thousands of faces during his years as a pastor. A look that said, nothing is worth getting excited about. Everything is a disappointment. He would have to try to do something about that look, if he could, later. In the meantime, he had to admit that their surroundings were not exactly awesomely impressive. The Oasen settlement wasn't what you'd call a city. More like a suburb erected in the middle of a wasteland. There were no streets in the formal sense, no pavements, no signs, no vehicles, and, despite the dim light and broad shadows of early dawn, no lamps or any evidence of electricity or fire. Just a community of buildings resting on bare ground. How many dwellings altogether? Peter couldn't guess. Maybe 500. Maybe more. They were spread out in unruly clusters, ranging in scale from single-story to three-floor blocks, all flat-roofed. The buildings were brick, obviously made of the same clay as the earth, but baked marble-smooth and caramel-coloured. There was not a soul to be seen. All the doors and windows were shut. Well, that wasn't quite true. The doors weren't made of wood, nor the windows of glass. They were merely holes in the buildings, shrouded with bead curtains. The beads were crystalline, like extravagant strings of jewellery. They swayed gently in the breeze. But there was nobody parting those curtains to peek out. Nobody walking through the doorways. Granger parked the vehicle right in front of a building which looked like all the others, except that it was marked by a painted white star, the bottom point of which had trickled slightly and dried that way. Peter and Granger stepped out and submitted to the atmosphere's embrace. Granger wrapped her scarf around her face, covering her mouth and nose, as though she considered the air impure. From a pocket of her slacks, she removed a metal gadget, which Peter assumed was a weapon. She pointed it at the vehicle and pressed the trigger twice. The engine switched off and a hatch in the back flipped open. In the absence of motor noise, the sounds of the Oasen settlement ventured onto the airwaves like opportunistic wildlife. The burble of running water from an invisible source. The occasional muffled clank or clunk, suggesting routine struggles with domestic objects. Distant squeaks and chortles that might be birds or children or machinery. And, closer by, the unintelligible murmur of voices, subtle and diffuse, emanating from the buildings like a hum. This place, despite outward appearances, was no ghost town.
So, do we just yell hello? Said Peter.
They know we're here, said Granger. That's why they're hiding. Her voice, muffled slightly by the scarf, sounded tense. She had her arms folded, and he could see a tongue of dark sweat in the armpit of her smock. How many times have you been here? He asked.
Dozens. I bring them their drug supply.
You're kidding. I'm a pharmacist.
I didn't know that.
She sighed. Looks like I totally wasted my breath when we first met. You didn't absorb a word I said, did you? My big speech of welcome, my detailed explanation of the procedure for getting stuff from the pharmacy if you need it. Sorry, my brains must have been scrambled. The jump does that to some people.
The wimpy ones, huh?
I didn't say that.
Granger hugged herself tightly, squeezing her upper arms in stress.
Come on, let's get this over with. This last was not addressed to him. She was staring at the building with the star painted on it. Are we in any danger?
None that I know of.
Peter leaned against the crash bar of the vehicle and made a more careful study of what he could see of the settlement. The buildings, although rectangular, had no hard edges. Each brick was a well-buffed lozenge, a glassy loaf of amber. The mortar had no grit to it. It was like plastic sealant. There wasn't a hard angle anywhere, nothing sharp or corrugated.
It was as though the architect's aesthetics had been formed in homage to children's play centres. Not that these buildings were in any way infantile or crass. They had their own uniform dignity, and they were obviously rock solid, and the warm colours were, well, warm. But Peter couldn't say he found the overall effect attractive. If God blessed him with the opportunity to build a church here, it would have to strike a different note, stand out against the squatness all around. At the very least, it would need to have... Yes, that's it. He'd worked out what was so dispiriting about this place. There was no attempt to reach up into the heavens. No tower, no turret, no flagpole. Not even a modest triangular roof. Oh, for a spire. Peter's vision of a church steeple shone in his mind just long enough for him to be oblivious to a movement in the bead curtain of the nearest doorway. By the time he blinked and focused, the figure had already stepped out and was confronting Granger. The event had occurred too suddenly, he felt. It lacked the drama appropriate to his first sighting of an Oasen native. It ought to have happened with ceremonial slowness, in an amphitheatre, or at the summit of a long staircase. Instead, the encounter was already underway, and Peter had missed its beginning. The creature, the person, stood upright but not tall. 5'3", maybe 5'4". Funny how those imperial measurements, inches, miles, stubbornly refused to be left behind. Anyway, he or she was delicate. Small-boned, narrow-shouldered, an unassuming presence. Not at all the fearsome figure Peter had prepared himself to confront. As foretold, a hood and monkish robes, made of pastel blue fabric, disconcertingly like bath towel, covered almost all of the body, its hems brushing the toes of soft leather boots. There was no swell of bosom, so Peter, aware that this was flimsy evidence on which to base a judgment, but unwilling to clutter his brain with unwieldy repetitions of he or she, decided to think of the creature as male. "Hi," said Granger, extending her hand. The Oasen extended his hand in return, but did not grasp Granger's. Rather, he touched her gently on the wrist with his fingertips. He was gloved. The gloves had 5 digits.
"You here now," he said. "A surprise."
His voice was soft, reedy, asthmatic sounding. Where the S's should have been, there was a noise like a ripe fruit being thumbed into 2 halves. "Not a bad surprise, I hope," said Granger.
"I hope to gather with you."
The Oasen turned to look at Peter, tilted his head slightly so that the shadows from the hood slid back. Peter, having been lulled by the Oasen's familiar shape and 5-fingered hands into expecting a more or less human face, flinched. Here was a face that was nothing like a face. Instead, it was a massive whitish-pink walnut kernel. Or no, even more, it resembled a placenta with 2 fetuses, maybe 3-month-old twins, hairless and blind, nestled head-to-head, knee-to-knee. Their swollen heads constituted the Oasen's clefted forehead, so to speak. Their puny ribbed backs formed his cheeks. Their spindly arms and webbed feet merged in a tangle of translucent flesh that might contain, in some form unrecognizable to him, a mouth, nose, eyes. Of course, there were no fetuses there, not really. The face was what it was, the face of an Oasen, nothing else. But try as he might, Peter couldn't decode it on its own terms. He could only compare it to something he knew. He had to see it as a grotesque pair of fetuses perched on someone's shoulders, half shrouded in a cowl. Because if he didn't allow it to resemble that, he would probably always have to stare at it dumbfounded, reliving the initial shock, dizzy with the vertigo of unsupported falling in that gut-wrenching instant before a solid comparison is found to clasp onto.
"You and I,"
said the Oasen.
"Never before now."
The vertical cleft in the middle of his face squirmed slightly as he formed the words. The fetuses rubbed knees, so to speak, Peter smiled, but could not summon a response. "He means he hasn't met you before," said Granger. "In other words, he's saying hello." "Hello," said Peter. "I'm Peter." The Oasis nodded.
"You are Peter. I will remember."
He turned back to Granger.
"You bring medicine."
"A little."
"How little?"
"I'll show you," said Granger, walking around to the back of the vehicle and lifting the hatch. She rummaged in the jumbled contents. Bottles of water, toilet paper, canvas bags, tools, tarps, and extracted a plastic tub no bigger than a school child's lunchbox. The Oasis followed every movement, although Peter was still unable to work out which parts of the face were its eyes. His eyes, sorry. "This is all I could get from our pharmacy," said Granger. "Today is not one of the official supply days, you understand? We're here for a different reason. But I didn't want to come with nothing, so this," she handed him the tub, "is extra. A gift."
"We are disappointed,"
said the Oasis.
"And in the same breath, we are grateful."
There was a pause. The Oasis stood holding his plastic tub. Granger and Peter stood watching him hold it. A ray of sunlight found its way to the roof of the vehicle, making it glow. "So, how are you?" said Granger. Sweat twinkled in her eyebrows and on her cheeks.
"I alone?"
inquired the Oasis.
"Or I and we together?"
He gestured vaguely at the settlement behind him. "All of you." The Oasis appeared to give this a great deal of thought. At last he said,
"Good."
There was another pause. "Is anyone else coming out today?" asked Granger. "To see us, I mean?" Again the Oasis mulled over the question, as though it were immensely complex.
"No,"
he concluded.
"I do there am only one."
He gestured solemnly at both Granger and Peter, in acknowledgement, perhaps, of his regret for the 2-to-1 imbalance between number of visitors and welcoming party. "Peter here is a special guest of USIC," said Granger. He's a Christian missionary. He wants to, live with you." She glanced at Peter for uneasy confirmation. "If I've got that right." "Yes," said Peter brightly. There was a glistening, champignon-like thing roughly halfway down the central cleft of the Oasis's face that he'd decided was his eye, and he looked straight at that, doing his best to radiate friendliness. "I have good news to tell you. The best news you've ever heard." The Oasis cocked his head to one side. The two fetuses, no, not fetuses, his brow and cheeks, please, blushed, revealing a spidery network of capillaries just beneath the skin. His voice, when it came, was even more asthmatic sounding than before.
"The gospel?"
The words hung in the whispering air for a second before Peter was able to take them in. He couldn't believe he'd heard correctly. Then he noticed that the Oasis's gloved hands had been pressed together in a steeple shape. "Yes," Peter cried, dizzy with elation. "Praise Jesus." The Oasis turned to Granger again. His gloved hands were trembling against the tub he held.
"We have waited long for the man, Peter,"
he said.
"Thank you, Granger."
And without further explanation, he hurried through the doorway, leaving the crystalline bead swinging in his wake. "Well, I'll be damned," said Granger, yanking her scarf loose and wiping her face with it. "He never called me by name before." They stood waiting for 20 minutes or so. The sun continued to rise, a sliver of brilliant burning orange, like a great bubble of lava on the horizon. The walls of the buildings glowed as if each brick had a light inside. At last, the Oasen returned, still clutching the plastic tub, which was now empty. He handed it back to Granger, very slowly and carefully, only letting it go when her grip on it was secure.
"Medicine have all gone," he said. "Gone inside the grateful."
"I'm sorry there wasn't more," said Granger. "There'll be more next time." The Oasen nodded.
"We abide."
Granger, stiff with unease, walked to the rear of the vehicle to stow the tub back in the trunk. As soon as her back was turned, the Oasen sidled up to Peter, bringing them face to face.
"Have you the book?"
"The book?"
"The Book of Strange New Things."
Peter blinked and tried to breathe normally. Up close, the Oasen's flesh smelled sweet. Not the sweet of rot, but sweet like fresh fruit.
"You mean the Bible," he said.
"We speak never the name. Power of the book forbid. Flame give warmth."
With outstretched hands, he mimed the action of warming oneself on a fire, getting too close, and being burned.
"But you mean the word of God," said Peter. "The gospel."
"The gospel. The technique of Jesus."
Peter nodded, but it took him a few seconds to decode the last word from its impeded passage through the Oasen's head cleft.
"Jesus,"
he echoed in wonder. The Oasen reached out one hand and, with an unmistakably tender motion, stroked Peter's cheek with the tip of a glove.
"We pray, Jesus, for your coming,"
he said. Granger's failure to rejoin them was, by now, obvious. Peter glanced round and saw her leaning on the back of the vehicle, pretending to study the gadget with which he'd unlocked the trunk. In that fraction of a second before he turned back to the Oasen, he felt the full intensity of her embarrassment.
"The book. You have the book?"
the Oasen repeated.
Not on me right now,"
said Peter, chastising himself for leaving his Bible back at the base.
"But yes, of course, of course."
The Oasen clapped his hands in a gesture of delight or prayer or both.
"Comfort and joy. Glad day. Come back soon, Peter. Oh, very soon. Sooner than you can. Read for us the Book of Strange New Things. Read and read and read until we understand. In reward, we give you.
The Oasen trembled with the effort of finding adequate words, then threw his hands wide, as if to indicate everything under the sun. "Yes," said Peter, laying a reassuring hand on the Oasen's shoulder. "Soon." The Oasen's brow, the heads of the fetuses, so to speak, swelled slightly. Peter decided that this, in these miraculous new people, was a smile.
"Dear Peter," wrote Beatrice, "I love you, and I hope you are well, but I must start this letter with some very bad news." It was like running toward an open doorway in a state of high enthusiasm and colliding with a pane of glass. He had spent the entire journey back to the base almost levitating with excitement. It was a wonder he hadn't floated straight through the roof of Granger's vehicle.
"Dear B, God be praised. We ask for a small break, and God gives us a miracle.
These were some of the ways he thought of beginning his message to Beatrice upon returning to his room. His fingers were poised to type at delirious speed, to shoot his delight through space, mistakes and all. There has been a terrible tragedy in the Maldives. A tidal wave. It was the height of the tourist season. The place was teeming with visitors, and it's got a population of about 1/3 of a million. Had. You know how when disasters happen, usually the media talks about how many people are estimated to have died. In this one, they're talking about how many people may be left alive. It's one vast swamp of bodies. You see it on the news footage, but you can't take it in. All those people with individual quirks and family secrets and special ways of wearing their hair, etc., reduced to what looks like a huge bog of meat that goes on for miles. The Maldives has had lots of islands, most of them at risk of flooding. So the government had been pushing for years to get the population to relocate to the biggest, best fortified atoll. By coincidence, there was a TV documentary crew making a film about a few islanders on one of the smaller atolls, who were protesting at being rehoused. The cameras were rolling when the tsunami hit. I've seen clips on my phone. You cannot believe what you are seeing. One second, an American anchor person voice is saying something about papaya groves, and the next second, a zillion tons of seawater smashes across the screen. Rescue crews save some of the Americans, a few tourists, a few of the locals. And the cameras, of course. That sounds cynical. I think they did what they could. Our church is considering what we can do to help. Sending people over there isn't an option. There's nothing we can achieve. Most of the islands are wiped off. There is nothing left except humps in the ocean. Even the biggest islands are probably never going to recover. All the fresh water has been fouled. There is not one fully intact, usable building. There is nowhere safe to land, nowhere to set up a hospital, no way of burying the dead. Helicopters are buzzing around like seagulls over an oil spill full of dead fish. At this stage, all we can do is pray for the relatives of Maldivians everywhere. And maybe, in time, they'll be refugees. I'm sorry to start this way. You can imagine my head and heart are full of it. It doesn't mean I haven't been thinking of you. Peter leaned back in his chair, lifted his face to the ceiling. The electric light was still on, superfluous now that the sunshine was beaming in, almost too bright to bear. He shivered, feeling the dampness in his clothes turning chilly in the air conditioning. He felt grief for the people of the Maldives. But to his shame, the grief was mingled with a purely selfish pang, the sense that he and Beatrice, for the first time since the beginning of their relationship, were not going through the same things together. In the past, whatever happened would happen to them both, like a power blackout or a late-night visit from a distressed friend or a rattling window frame while they were trying to sleep, or like sex. "I miss you," wrote Beatrice. "This Maldives thing wouldn't have upset me so much if you'd been here. Tell me more about your mission. Is it horrendously difficult? Remember that unexpected breakthroughs often come directly after everything has seemed impossible. The ones who insist they don't want or need God are the ones who want and need him most." Joshua is still playing his tricks. "I'm seriously considering slipping him a Mickey Finn in his evening milk, or hitting him on the head with a mallet when he wakes me up again at 4 a.m. Alternatively, maybe I should make a life-size dummy of you to lie next to me in the bed. That might fool him." Sadly, it wouldn't fool me. The Mira situation is under control now. I got together with a Muslim social worker, Khadija, who liaises with the imam at Mira's local mosque. Basically, we're trying to sell it to the imam as a human decency issue, the husband's violence / lack of respect, rather than a religion versus religion issue. It's hardcore diplomacy, as you can imagine, like brokering a peace deal between Syria and the USA. But Khadija is brilliant. "I got a message from USIC saying you're fine." "How would they know?" "I suppose they mean they can verify you didn't get vaporized. The message was sent by Alex Granger. Have you met him? Tell him he can't spell liaise. Or maybe there's a simplified American way of spelling it now. Bitch, bitch, bitch.
But I've been tolerant all day, honest.
Very difficult new patient on the ward, supposedly transferred down from psych for medical reasons, but I think they were just desperate to get rid of her. Anyway, I feel like being outrageously unfair to someone for just 3 minutes to let it rip. I won't, of course. I'll be very nice, even to Joshua when he wakes me up again in the small hours. Seriously, I'm missing you terribly. Wish I could spend just a few minutes in your arms. Okay, maybe an hour. Weather is better. Lovely sunshine today, but it's not cheering me up. Went to the supermarket for some comfort food, chocolate mousse, tiramisu, you know the sort of thing. Turns out lots of other people had the same idea. Everything I wanted was out of stock, a blank space on the shelf. Settled for one of those roulette things with the fake cream inside. Head full of Maldives tragedy, stomach full of dessert. What fortunate people we are in our Western playground. We watch the footage of foreign dead on video clips and then mosey out to the supermarket in search of our favourite treats. Of course, when I say we, I can't speak for you right now. You are far from all this. Far from me. Ignore this self-pitying prattle. I'll be fine by tomorrow. Let me know how you're going. I'm so proud of you. Kisses, hugs. I wish. Beatrice. P.S. Want a cat? My dear B, he wrote back. I hardly know what to say. How dreadful about the Maldives. The scale of such a tragedy is, as you say, almost impossible to imagine. I'll pray for them. Those sentences, short as they were, took him a long while to write. A full 3 to 5 minutes for each. He racked his brains for an additional sentence that would make a dignified transition from the disaster to his own glad tidings. Nothing came. I've had my first meeting with an Oasis native, he went on, trusting that B would understand. Contrary to my wildest hopes, they are hungry for Christ. They know of the Bible. I didn't have mine with me at the time. That'll teach me never to go anywhere without it. I don't know why I left it behind. I suppose I assumed that the first visit would be basically reconnaissance, and that the response would be negative. But as Jesus says in John 4, say not ye, there are yet 4 months before the harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look upon the fields, for they are ripe already. The settlement is not at all what I expected. There is no evidence of industrialization. It could be the Middle East in the Middle Ages, with different architecture, of course. No electricity, apparently. It's also in the middle of nowhere, a long, long way from the USIC base. I don't think it will be feasible for me to live here and travel there on a regular basis. I will have to go and live with the Oasis, and as soon as possible. I haven't discussed any of the practicalities. Yes, yes, I know, I really need you with me. But God is well aware that I'm clueless in that area. I'll have to trust that everything will fall into place. There seems plenty of reason to hope that it will. The Oasis, assuming the one I met was typical, are average height and look remarkably like us, except for their faces, which are a gruesome sort of jumble, impossible to describe, really, like fetuses. You don't know what to look at when you're talking to them. They speak English with a strong accent. Well, the one I met did. Maybe he's the only one who speaks any English, and my original assumption that I would spend several months learning the language before I made any headway will still be borne out. But I have a feeling that God has been at work here already, more than I dared imagine. Anyway, I'm going straight back there as soon as I can. I was going to say tomorrow, but with the periods of daylight being several days long here, the word tomorrow is a problem. I must find out what the USIC personnel do to get round that one. I'm sure they have a solution. I'll ask Granger during the drive, if I remember. My mind's a bit overexcited, as you can imagine. I'm just raring to go back to that settlement, take my place among these extraordinary people, and satisfy their thirst for the gospel. What a privilege to... He stopped typing, midway through, what a privilege to serve the Lord. He had remembered the Maldives, or, more to the point, he'd become aware that he'd forgotten all about them in his enthusiasm. B's uneasy, almost anxious mood, so unlike her, was at odds with his exuberance.
like a funeral dirge interrupted by the cheery hootings of a passing carnival. Rereading the opening line of his letter, he could see that his acknowledgement of her distress was pretty cursory. In normal circumstances, he would have embraced her. The pressure of his arms against her back and the nudge of his cheek against her hair would have said it all. But now, the written word was all he had. He considered elaborating on how he felt about the Maldives. But he didn't feel much. At least, not about the Maldives themselves. His feelings were largely regret, disappointment even, that the tragedy had affected Beatrice so badly. Just when he wanted her to be happy and all right and getting on with things as usual and receptive to his wonderful news about the Oasens. His stomach gurgled loudly. He hadn't eaten since the drive back from the settlement when he and Granger had nibbled at the dried out remainder of the raisin bread. $5 a slice, she'd remarked ruefully. He hadn't asked who was footing the bill. As if by mutual agreement, they had not discussed the Oasens' extraordinary response to Peter. Instead, Granger explained various routine procedures relating to laundry, electric appliances, availability of vehicles, canteen etiquette. She was irritable, insisting that she'd briefed him on these things before, when she first escorted him off the ship. The forgiveness joke didn't work a third time. Peter stood up and walked to the window. The sun, egg-yellow and hazy-edged at this time of day, was clearly visible from his quarters, right in the middle of the sky. It was 4 or 5 times bigger than the sun he'd grown up with, and it cast a rim of golden light along the contours of the airport compound's drab buildings. Puddles of rainwater, left by last night's deluge, had been evaporating steadily since then. The vapors twirled and danced as they flew off the ground and past the rooftops into oblivion, as if the puddles were blowing sophisticated smoke rings. The air conditioning in his room was unnecessarily cool. He found that if he stepped closer to the window, almost pressing his body against it, the warmth from outside radiated through the glass and permeated his clothing. He would have to ask Granger about adjusting the aircon. It was one of the points they hadn't covered. Back at the message screen, he finished typing, "Serve the Lord," and started a fresh paragraph. "Even in my joy at this wonderful opportunity that God has laid before me, I feel an ache of grief that I can't hold you and comfort you. I only realize today that this is the first time you and I have been apart for longer than a couple of nights. Couldn't I have gone on a mini mission to Manchester or Cardiff first as a practice exercise before coming all the way here? I think you would find Oasis as beautiful as I do. The sun is huge and yellow. The air swirls around constantly and slips in and out of your clothes. That may sound unpleasant, I know, but you get used to it. The water is green and my urine comes out orange. I'm doing a great job of selling the place to you, aren't I? I should have taken a course in novel writing before I volunteered for this. I should have insisted to Usyk that we went together or I didn't go at all. Maybe if we'd bent their arm on that one, we could then have insisted that Joshua came along too. Not sure how he would have fared in the jump, though. Probably would have been transformed into a furry tea cosy. Feeble cat jokes. My equivalent of your chocolate roulettes, I suppose. Darling, I love you. Keep well. Take the wise advice that you've given me so often. Don't be hard on yourself, and don't let the bad blind you to the good. I'll join you in prayer for the relatives of the dead in the Maldives. Join me in prayer for the people here, who are thrilled at the prospect of a new life in Christ. Oh, and also, there is a girl in Oskaloosa called Coretta, whose father has recently died, and whose mother has hit the booze. Pray for her too, if you remember. Love, Peter." He read the text of his message over, but didn't tinker with it any further, feeling suddenly faint with hunger and fatigue. He pressed a button. For several minutes, his 793 inadequate words hung there, trembling slightly, as if unsure what to do. That was normal for the shoot, he'd found. The process kept you in suspense each time, tempting you to fear that it would fail. Then his words vanished and the screen went blank, except for the automated logo that said, "Approved. Transmitted." Chapter 8. take a deep breath and count to a million. Everything looked different in daylight. The Usyk mess hall, which had seemed so lonesome and eerie during the long hours of darkness, was a hive of cheerful activity now. A happy congregation. The glass wall on the eastern side of the building, although tinted, let in so much light and warmth that Peter had to shield his face from it. A glow was cast over the entire room, transforming coffee machines into jeweled sculptures, aluminium chairs into precious metal, magazine racks into ziggurats, bald heads into lamps. 30 or 40 people were gathered together, eating, chatting, fetching refills from the coffee bar, lolling around in the armchairs, gesticulating over the tables, raising their voices to compete with the raised voices of the others. Most were dressed in white, just like Peter, although sans the big inky crucifix on the chest. There were quite a few black faces, including BG's. BG didn't look up when Peter arrived. He was involved in an animated discussion with a rather butch-looking white woman. There was no sign of Granger. Peter stepped into the throng. Piped music was still issuing from the PA system, but it was barely audible above the clamour of conversation. Peter couldn't tell whether it was the same Patsy Cline documentary, or an electronic disco song, or a piece of classical music. Just another voice in the hubbub.
"Hey, preacher."
It was the black man who tossed him the blueberry muffin. He was seated at the same table as last night, but with a different pal, a fat white guy. In fact, both of them were fat. Exactly the same weight and with similar features. Coincidences like that served as a reminder that, variations in pigment aside, humans were all part of the same species. "Hi there," said Peter, pulling up a seat and joining them. They each glanced at his chest to check out the ink-stained design there, but, having satisfied themselves that it was a crucifix rather than something they might wish to comment on, pulled their heads back again.
"How's things, man?"
The black guy extended his hand for a handshake. Mathematical formulae were jotted on the sleeve of his shirt, right up to the elbow. "Very good," said Peter. It had never occurred to him before that dark-skinned people didn't have the option of jotting numbers on their skin. You learn something new about human diversity every day.
"You got yourself fed yet?"
The black man had just polished off a plate of something brown and saucy. He nursed a jumbo plastic mug of coffee. His friend nodded a greeting to Peter and unwrapped a soggy napkin from around a large sandwich.
"No, I'm still functioning on half a muffin," said Peter, blinking dazedly in the light.
"Actually, that's not quite true. I've had some raisin bread since then."
"Lay off that raisin bread, man. It's NRC.
NRC? Peter consulted his mental database of acronyms. "Not recommended for children?"
"Not real coke."
"I don't follow you."
"It's our cute way of saying that it was made here and not back home. Probably contains monocycloparaffins or cyclohexyl dodecanoic acid or some shit like that."
The black man was half smiling, but his eyes were serious. The polysyllabic chemical terms had rolled off his tongue with the ease of obscenities. Again, Peter was reminded that each and every member of this personnel must possess skills that amply justified the cost of his or her passage to Oasis. Every member except him. The black man took a loud slurp of coffee. Peter asked, "Do you never eat anything that's been made here?"
"My body is my temple, preacher, and you gotta keep it holy. The Bible says that."
"The Bible says a lot of things, Mooney,"
his pal remarked, and took a big bite out of his sandwich, which dripped grey sauce. Peter glanced across the room at BG. The butch-looking white woman was laughing, almost doubled up. She had one hand on BG's knee for balance. The piped music poked through a gap in the noise, revealing the chorus of a Broadway song from the mid-20th century, the sort of stuff Peter had always associated with provincial charity shops or the record collections of lonely old men.
"How's your sandwich?" he inquired. "Looks pretty good."
"Mmm,"
nodded the fat white guy.
"It is good."
"What's in it?"
"White flour."
"Apart from the bread?"
"White flour, preacher. Not white flour, F-L-O-U-R. White flour,
F-L-O-W-E-R. Roast white flour.
Mooney came to the rescue. My friend Russo is talking about a flower. He made an elegant hand gesture, unfurling his plump fingers in imitation of an opening blossom. A flower that grows here. Just about the only thing that grows here.
Tastes like the best pastrami you ever had in your life, said Russo.
It's very adaptable, Mooney conceded. Depending on the flavors you put in, it can be made to taste like just about any damn thing. Chicken, fudge, beefsteak, banana, sweet corn, mushroom. Add water and it's soup. Boil it down and it's jelly. Grind and bake it and it's bread. The universal food.
You're doing a very good job of selling it, said Peter, for someone who refuses to eat it.
Sure he eats it, said Russo. He loves the banana fritters.
They're okay, sniffed Mooney. I don't make a habit of it. Mainly I insist on the real deal.
But isn't it expensive? Asked Peter.
If you only eat and drink, imported stuff.
You bet, Preacher. At the rate I'm drinking real Coke, I estimate I owe Usyk maybe in the region of $50,000.
Easy, confirmed Russo. That and the Twinkies.
Hell yeah. The prices these sharks charge for a Twinkie or a Hershey bar. I tell you, if I wasn't the easygoing type...
Mooney slid his empty plate toward Peter.
If I hadn't eaten it all, I could show you something else, he said. Vanilla ice cream and chocolate sauce. The vanilla essence and the chocolate is imported. The sauce has maybe some white flour in it, but the ice cream is pure entomophagy. Know what I'm saying?
Peter reflected a moment.
No, Mooney, I don't know what you're saying. Bugs, man. Grubs. You scream, I scream, we all scream for... We're bugs.
Very funny, mumbled Russo,
and continued chewing his mouthful with less enthusiasm than before. And they do a delicious rice dessert that uses... Can you believe this? It uses maggots.
Russo put down his sandwich.
Mooney, you're my pal. I love you a lot, but...
Not dirty maggots, you understand, Mooney explained. Clean, fresh, specially bred ones.
Russo had had enough.
Mooney, put a goddamn sock in it. There are some things it's better for a person not to know.
As if alerted by the sounds of dispute, BG abruptly hove into view.
Hey, Peter, how's tricks, bro?
The white woman was no longer at his side.
Excellent, BG. And you?
On top of it, man. On top of it. We got the solar panels putting out 250% of our electric power now. We're ready to pump the surplus into some seriously smart systems.
He nodded toward an invisible location somewhere beyond the mess hall, on the opposite side from where Peter had explored.
You seen their new building out there?
They all look new to me, BG.
Yeah, well, this one is real new.
BG's face was serene with pride.
You go out there and look at it sometime when you get the opportunity. It's a beautiful piece of engineering.
A new rain-collecting centrifuge. Otherwise known as the Big Brazier,
interjected Russo, mopping up the sauce with a fragment of bread crust.
Hey, we ain't looking to win no architecture prizes, grinned BG. Just figuring out how to catch that water.
Actually, said Peter, now that you mention it, it's just occurred to me, despite all the rain, I haven't seen any rivers or lakes, not even a pond. The ground is like a sponge. Anything that goes in, you don't get back. But most of the rain evaporates in like 5 minutes. You can't see it happening. It's constant. Invisible steam. That's an oxymoron, right?
I suppose so, said Peter.
Anyway, we got to grab that rain before it disappears. That's what me and the team been designing. Vacuum nets, flow concentrators, big, big toys.
And what about you, bro? You got yourself a church yet?
The question was asked lightly, as if churches were tools or other necessary supplies that could be requisitioned, which, on reflection, they were.
Not the physical building, BG, said Peter. But that's never been what a church is about. A church is made of hearts and minds.
Low budget construction, quipped Russo.
Show some respect, asshole,
said Mooney.
Actually, BG, said Peter, I'm kind of in a state of shock, or happy astonishment would be a better word. Last night, this morning, earlier today, Granger took me to the Oasis settlement.
The what, bro?
The Oasis settlement. The three men laughed.
You mean Freaktown,
said Russo.
C2, corrected BG, abruptly serious.
We call it C2.
Anyway, Peter continued, I got the most amazing welcome. These people are desperate to learn about God.
Well, ain't that a lick on the dick, said BG.
They already know about the Bible.
This calls for celebration, bro. Let me buy you a drink.
I don't drink, BG. BG raised one eyebrow.
I'm in a coffee, bro. If you want alcohol, you're going to need to set up your church real fast.
Sorry?
Donations, bro. Lots of donations. One beer will set you back a long way.
BG lumbered toward the coffee bar. Peter was left alone with the two fat guys, who took synchronized sips from their plastic mugs.
It's extraordinary the way you can be driven through a landscape for hours and yet not notice the most striking thing about it, reflected Peter. All that rain, and none of it collected in lakes or reservoirs. I wonder how the Oasis cope.
No problem, said Russo. It rains every day. They get what they need when they need it. It's like on tap.
He held up his plastic mug to an imagined sky.
In fact, added Mooney, it would be a problem if the ground didn't soak it up. Imagine the floods, man.
Oh, said Peter, suddenly remembering. Have you heard about the Maldives?
The Maldives?
Russo looked wary, as though suspecting that Peter was about to launch into an evangelistic parable.
The Maldives, a bunch of islands in the Indian Ocean, said Peter.
They got wiped out by tidal waves. Almost everyone who lived there is dead.
I didn't know that,
said Mooney, impassive, as though Peter had just imparted a fragment of knowledge from a branch of science outside his own.
Wiped out? Said Russo. And that's bad.
BG returned to the table with a steaming mug of coffee in each fist.
Thanks,
said Peter, taking hold of his. There was a jokey message printed on it. You don't need to be human to work here, but it helps. BG said something different.
Hey, I've just realized, said Peter. These mugs are real plastic. I mean, thick plastic. I mean, not styrofoam, not disposable.
We got better things to transport halfway across the universe than disposable cups, bro, said BG.
Yeah, like Hershey bars, said Mooney.
Like Christian ministers,
said BG, without a hint of mockery.
My dear B, wrote Peter an hour later. No reply from you yet, and maybe it's a bit soon for me to be writing you another letter, but I couldn't wait to tell you. I've just had a most eye-opening conversation with some of the USIC guys. It turns out I'm not the first Christian missionary that's been sent here. Before me, there was a man called Marty Kurtzberg, a Baptist apparently, despite the Jewish name. His ministry was welcomed by the natives, but then he disappeared. That was a year ago. No one knows what became of him. Of course, the men joked that the Oasis probably ate him, like in those old cartoons of missionaries tied up and getting boiled in a pot by hungry savages. They shouldn't talk like that. It's racist. But anyway, I know in my heart that these people, the Oasis that is, aren't dangerous. Not to me, anyway. Maybe that's a rash assessment, since I've only met one so far. But I'm sure you recall the times when you and I were witnessing for the Lord in some unfamiliar place slash context, and we suddenly sensed that we should beat a hasty retreat if we wanted to stay alive. Well, I don't get that feeling here. Despite the cannibalism jokes, USIC and the Oasis have what appears to be quite a decent trading relationship. It's not the colonial model of exploitation that you'd expect. There's a regular exchange of goods, formal and low-key. The Oasis provide us with basic foodstuffs. As I understand it, the main thing we've been giving the Oasis is medicines. There's not a great variety of plants growing here, which is surprising given the amount of rain.
But since most medicines are made from plants, I suspect that the scope for discovering slash making analgesics, antibiotics, etc. here has been limited. Or maybe this is Usyk's evil plan to get the locals hooked on drugs. I won't be able to make authoritative statements about that until I know these people better. Anyway, are you sitting down? Because I have some amazing news that may knock you flat. The Oasens want only one thing besides medicines. The word of God. They've been asking Usyk to supply them with another pastor. Asking? Demanding! According to the men I just spoke to, they, Oasens, have let it be known, politely, that their continued cooperation with Usyk's activities depends on it. And here's you and me thinking that Usyk was being fantastically generous in offering me this opportunity to come here. Well, far from me being here under sufferance, it turns out the whole project may depend on me. If I'd known this before, I would have insisted that you came too. But then maybe Usyk would have passed me over in favour of someone else, someone less troublesome. There must have been hundreds of applicants. I still don't understand why me. But perhaps the right question is why not? Anyway, it's clear that I'll be given whatever assistance I require in the setting up of my church. A vehicle, building materials, even labourers. The way things are shaping up, it looks like my yoke is going to be easier than that of just about any missionary since the beginning of Christian evangelism. When you think of St. Paul getting beaten up, stoned, shipwrecked, starved, imprisoned, I'm almost looking forward to my first setback. Almost. He paused. That was all he wanted to say, but he felt he should make some reference to the Maldives, and then felt guilty for feeling he should, rather than wanting to. Love, Peter. After he vomited up the coffee, he felt better. He wasn't much of a coffee drinker at the best of times. It was a stimulant after all, and he'd weaned himself off artificial stimulants years ago. But the stuff BG had presented him with tasted foul. Maybe it was made of Oasen flowers, or maybe the combination of imported coffee and Oasen water was bad news. Either way, he felt better rid of it. In fact, he felt almost normal. The effects of the jump were leaving his system at last. He took a long swig of water straight from the tap. Delicious. He would drink only water from now on. Energy returned to his body, as though each cell was a microscopic sponge that swelled in gratitude for being fed. Maybe it was. He strapped on his sandals and left his quarters, ostensibly to get the hang of his surroundings, but also to celebrate feeling vigorous again. He'd been cooped up too long. Free at last. Well, free to walk the labyrinth of the Usyk base. A welcome change from his room, but not exactly the wide-open prairie. Just empty corridors, brightly lit tunnels of wall, ceiling and floor, and every few meters, a door. Each door had a name tag on it, surname and initial only, with the person's job description in larger letters. Thus, W. Heck, chef. S. Mortellaro, dental surgeon. D. Rosen, surveyor. L. Moro, engineering technologist. B. Graham, centrifuge engineer. J. Mooney, electrical engineer, and so on. The word engineer came up often, as did professions ending in ist. No sound came through those doors, and the corridors were likewise silent. Evidently, the Usyk staff were either at work or hanging out in the cafeteria. There was nothing sinister in their absence, no reason to feel spooked, yet Peter felt spooked. His initial relief at being able to reconnoiter alone, unwatched, gave way to a hankering for signs of life. He walked with increasing pace, turned corners with increasing resolution, and was met each time with the same rectangular passageways and rows of identical doors. In a place like this, you couldn't even be sure if you were lost. Just as he was starting to sweat, needled with the memories of being trapped in juvenile corrective institutions, the spell was broken. Turning another corner, he almost collided, chest to chest, with Werner. "Whoa! Where's the fire?" Werner said, patting his fat torso, as if checking that the surprise hadn't done him any harm. "Sorry," said Peter.
You okay?
Yes, thank you.
That's good, nodded Werner, cordial, but in no mood to chat. Stay with it, man.
A catchphrase or a caution? Hard to tell.
Within seconds, Peter was alone once more. His moment of panic had passed. He could see now that there was a difference between wandering around in an unfamiliar building and being trapped in a prison. Werner was right. He needed to get a grip. Back in his own quarters, Peter prayed. Prayed for guidance. No answer came to him, at least not immediately. The alien, the Oasen, had begged him to return to the settlement as soon as he could. So, should he go right away? The claustrophobia that had threatened him in the corridors suggested that he still wasn't fully back to normal. He wasn't a panicker, usually. And it wasn't long since he'd been fainting, vomiting, and hallucinating. Perhaps he should continue resting up until he was 100% sure he was himself again. But the Oasen had begged him to return. And Yusik hadn't brought him all this way for him to lie in bed staring at his toes. He should go. He should go. The thing was, it would mean being out of contact with B for a number of days. That would be hard on both of them, yet, in the circumstances, there was no avoiding it. The best he could do was delay his departure just a little while longer, so that they had more time to write to each other first. He checked the chute. Nothing.
Come back soon, Pika. Oh, very soon. Sooner than you can. Read for us the Book of Strange New Things.
He could still hear the Oasen's voice, wheezy and strained, as though each word was well-nigh impossible to produce. A bleat from a musical instrument made of preposterously ill-suited materials. A trombone carved out of a watermelon, held together with rubber bands. But never mind the physicalities. Here were souls hungry for Christ, waiting for him to return as he had promised. But had he promised in so many words? He couldn't recall. God's answer resounded in his head. Don't make everything so complicated. Do what you came here for. Yes, Lord, he responded in turn. But is it okay if I wait for just one more letter from B?
Frazzled from waiting, he went out into the corridors again. They were silent as before, still empty, and smelled of nothing. Not even floor cleaner, although they were very clean. Not showroom pristine or shiny, but free of noticeable dirt or dust. Sensibly clean. He'd been wrong to feel claustrophobic. Only a few of the passageways were enclosed. Others had windows, big ones with sunshine beaming in. How could he have missed this before? How had he managed to choose only the windowless passageways? That was the sort of thing crazy people did, instinctively choosing the experiences that confirmed their own negative attitudes. He was a past master of stuff like that. God had shown him a better way. God and B. He walked along, rereading the names on the doors, trying to commit them to memory in case he ever needed to know where to find someone. He was struck anew by how odd it was that none of the doors was fitted with a lock, just a simple handle which any stranger could open.
You planning to steal my toothpaste?
Russo had teased when Peter remarked on this earlier on. No, but you might have possessions that are very individual to you.
You planning to steal my shoes?
Peter had stolen someone's shoes once, and considered mentioning it, but Mooney interrupted.
He wants your muffins, man. Watch your muffins.
By coincidence, Peter noted the nameplate of F. Russo, operating engineer, on one of the doors, and walked on. Seconds later, he noted another name in passing, and then almost lost his balance when it registered on his consciousness. M. Kurtzberg, pastor. Why was he so surprised? Kurtzberg was missing in action, but no one had said he was dead. Until his fate was established, there was no reason to reallocate his quarters or remove his name. He might return any time. On impulse, Peter knocked at the door. There was no answer. He knocked again, louder. Again, no answer.
He should, of course, move on, but he did not. Within moments, he was standing inside the room. It was a room identical to his own, in design and decor at least. The window blind was shut.
Hello?
He called quietly, to verify that he was alone. He tried to convince himself that Kurtzberg, if he had been here, would have urged him to come in. And although this was probably true, it didn't alter the fact that it was wrong to enter a stranger's home uninvited. But this isn't a home, is it? He thought to himself. The USIC base isn't a home for anybody. It's just one big workplace. Self-justifying sophistry? Perhaps. But no, it was an instinct that went deeper than that. B would have sensed it too. There was something weird about the USIC personnel, something B could have helped him articulate. These people had been living here for years. They obviously enjoyed a degree of camaraderie. And yet... He stepped deeper into Kurtzberg's apartment. There was no evidence of any other illicit visits before this one. The atmosphere was stale, and a film of dust covered the flat surfaces. There was no chute on the table, just a bottle of filtered water, half empty and pure-looking, and a plastic mug. The bed was unmade, with one pillow hanging off the edge, poised to fall. Placidly established in that poise, set to hang there forever. Spread out on the bed was one of Kurtzberg's shirts, its sleeves upflung as if in surrender. The armpits were discoloured with mildew. Disappointingly, there were no documents anywhere to be seen. No diaries or notebooks. There was a Bible, a neat paperback Revised Standard Version, lying on a chair. Peter opened it, riffled through the pages. Kurtzberg, he soon realized, was not the sort of person who underlined verses that struck him as particularly significant, or who scribbled annotations in the margins. There was nothing here but pristine scripture. Peter, in his own sermons, would occasionally tell a joke or an aphorism to drive home a point. And one of the dictums he enjoyed quoting, whenever he sensed that people in the congregation were staring at his grubby, decrepit, dog-eared New Testament, was clean Bible, dirty Christian. Dirty Bible, clean Christian. Marty Kurtzberg obviously did not subscribe to this view. Peter opened the wardrobe. A formal suit jacket in powder blue linen hung there, next to a pair of white slacks with faint grey stains on the knees. Kurtzberg was a compact man, no taller than 5'6", and his shoulders were narrow. Two more coat hangers were cloaked in shirts of the same kind as the one on the bed, replete with classy silk ties slung loosely around the collars. On the bottom of the wardrobe lay a pair of leather shoes, polished to a gleam, and a wadded-up pair of cream socks that were furry with mould. "I'm not going to learn anything here," thought Peter, and turned to leave. As he turned, though, he noticed something lying under the window, a litter of what looked like flower petals. On closer inspection, it proved to be torn fragments of adhesive bandage, dozens of them, as if Kurtzberg had stood at the window, staring out at goodness knows what, and ripped up an entire packet of band-aids one by one into shreds as small as possible, letting them fall at his feet. After his visit to Kurtzberg's quarters, Peter lost all motivation to explore the USIC compound any further. A pity, because this was his chance to make up for forgetting all the orienteering info Granger had told him on arrival. Walking around was good exercise too. No doubt his muscles needed it. But, well, to be truthful, this place made him depressed. He wasn't sure why. The compound was spacious, clean, cheerfully painted, and there were plenty of windows. Okay, a few of the corridors were a bit tunnel-like, but they couldn't all face onto the sky, could they? And okay, a few potted plants here and there might have been nice, but USIC could hardly be blamed if the soil of Oasis didn't support ferns and rhododendrons. And it wasn't as if no attempt had been made to finesse the decor. At regular intervals in the corridors hung nicely framed posters that were intended, presumably, to raise a smile. Peter noted perennial favourites, like the photo of the worried-looking kitten hanging upside down from a twig, captioned, "Oh shit." The dog sharing his basket with two ducks. Laurel and Hardy cluelessly attempting to build a house. The elephant balancing on a ball. The convoy of forward-striding cartoon men in Robert Crumb's Keep on Truckin', and, at impressive size, from chest height to just under the ceiling, Charles Ebbett's famous monochrome of construction workers eating lunch on an iron girder, suspended vertiginously above the streets of Manhattan. A little further on, Peter wondered whether the 1940s propaganda painting titled We Can Do It, showing Rosie the Riveter flexing her well-muscled forearm, was intended sincerely to inspire the personnel, or if it had been fixed there with a wink of irony. In any case, some sly graffitist had added, in felt tip, "No thanks, Rosie." Not all the pictures alluded to construction projects and tough challenges. There was a quotient of art for art's sake as well. Peter noted several classic screen prints by Mucha and Toulouse-Lautrec, a collage by Braque or someone of that ilk, and a giant photograph labelled Andreas Gursky, Rhine 2, that was almost abstract in its simple stripes of green field and blue river. There were also facsimiles of old movie posters featuring matinee idols from the far distant past. Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, Marlene Dietrich, even Rudolph Valentino. Something for everybody. The range couldn't be faulted, really. Although there was a curious absence of any image that evoked a specific, currently existing spot on Earth, or a passionate emotion. Craving fresh air, Peter headed for the nearest door that led outside. Whether the ocean of humid air that rushed to greet him when he emerged into the sunshine could be called fresh was, of course, debatable. It certainly wasn't stagnant. Wisps of it lifted locks of his hair to caress his scalp, while other currents slipped into his clothing and sought out the flesh he'd tried to keep covered. But it was better this time. His dish dasher was a single layer between him and the atmosphere, and once it became damp, which happened within seconds, it hung off him loosely, a bit heavy on the shoulders, but comfortable everywhere else. The fabric, though thin enough not to be stifling, was tightly woven enough to conceal the fact that he wore nothing else underneath, and stiff enough not to cling. The atmosphere got on well with it. He walked briskly along the tarmac, along the outer wall of the USIC building, taking advantage of the shade cast by the concrete monstrosity. The sandals allowed his feet to breathe. The sweat between his toes evaporated as soon as it formed. The air tickled his shins and ankles, which ought to have been unpleasant, but was really quite delightful. His mood was much improved. The unease he'd felt indoors already forgotten. Turning a corner, he found himself passing alongside the windowed exterior of the mess hall. The sun blazed on the glass, making it difficult for him to see through. But he got a vague impression of the tables and chairs and the people gathered in there. He waved blindly into the haze in case anyone had spotted him and might be waving to him. He wouldn't want them to think he was snubbing them. Averting his eyes from the glare, he caught sight of something unexpected, a large gazebo situated a couple of hundred meters from the main building. Its canopy was bright yellow, made of canvas or sailcloth, slackly stretched over the support struts. Peter had once conducted a wedding under such a structure. He'd also seen them at the seaside and in public gardens. They provided shelter from sun and rain and could be easily dismantled, although this one looked more permanent. There was movement inside its shade, so he ambled over to investigate. Five people were under the gazebo, dancing. Not in pairs, but alone. Maybe they weren't dancing. Maybe it was a Tai Chi session. Approaching nearer still, Peter saw that they were in fact exercising. This place was a sort of outdoor gym, furnished not with high-tech electric treadmills and ergometers, but with simple wooden and metal structures that resembled children's playground equipment. Mora was there, pumping her legs on the padded sidebars of a weighted wheel. BG was there, lifting sandbags on a pulley. The other three were unknown to Peter. Wet with sweat, all five applied themselves to their brightly painted mechanisms, stretching, pacing, twisting, bowing.
"Yay, Peter!" called BG,
without interrupting the rhythm of his workout. His arms, as he flexed them to raise and lower the bags, were as thick as Peter's legs, and the knots of muscle bulged as though inflated by a puffer. He wore baggy shorts that reached down to his calves and a skimpy cotton singlet, through which his nipples poked like rivets.
That looks like hard work, BG, said Peter. Work, play, it's all the same to me, BG replied.
Morrow didn't acknowledge Peter's arrival, but then the position she was in, flat on her back with her legs in the air pedaling, might have made that problematic. She wore a white shalwar whose waistband had slipped under her hip bones, and a sleeveless t-shirt that left her midriff bare. Sweat had saturated the fabric, rendering it semi-transparent. She breathed loudly and rhythmically. BG had an unimpeded view.
On top of it, man! On top of it! He exclaimed.
At first, Peter took this to be a bawdy pun. It would fit in with the sexualized banter on the ship and BG's generally bullish air. But as he looked into BG's face, he realized that the man was abstracted, gazing at no particular object, focused on his own exercise. Morrow might or might not be registering on his consciousness as a blur of movement, but as a woman, she was invisible to him. There was another female here, too, a tall, sinewy Caucasian with sparse red hair pulled into a ponytail. Her legs dangled inches off the ground as she supported herself between two parallel bars. She smiled at Peter, but it was a smile that said, "Let's be properly introduced someday when I'm not so busy." The two unknown men were similarly preoccupied. One stood on a low pedestal with a swivel base, his eyes fixed on his own feet as he gyrated his hips. The other sat on a spider-like structure with many rungs and was touching his cheeks to his knees. His hands were interlocked behind his head, as tightly as the metal rungs in which he'd hooked his feet. He was a closed circuit of exertion. He heaved himself forward, and one of his knotty vertebrae seemed to pop out of his skin and fly into the air. Actually, it was an insect. The gazebo was a harbor for grasshopper-like bugs, which settled calmly on the humans here and there, but mostly just crawled on the canvas, green against the yellow. The gazebo area contained enough equipment for a dozen people. Peter wondered if it was bad form not to join in. Maybe he should pick a gadget and do a small workout, just a few minutes. Enough to be able to walk away without seeming to have come here solely to spectate. But he'd never been a formal exercise kind of guy, and he would feel foolish pretending. Anyway, he was a newbie, and surely people could understand that he needed to check the place out.
Nice day, remarked Morrow.
She'd stopped pedaling and was taking a breather.
More than nice. Beautiful, said Peter. Sure is, said Morrow, and swigged some water from a bottle.
One of the green insects had attached itself to her top between the breasts like a brooch. She paid it no mind.
Did the coffee come out? Said Peter.
She looked at him uncomprehendingly.
Coffee?
The coffee I made you spill.
Oh, that!
Her expression implied she'd engaged with a dozen challenges and activities since then, and could hardly be expected to remember an event so trivial.
It wasn't coffee.
White flour?
Chicory and rye extract. And yeah, just a bit of white flour. To give it body.
I must try it sometime.
It's worth trying. Don't expect the most wonderful thing on earth, and you won't be disappointed.
A sound philosophy is a general rule, he said. Again, she looked at him as if he was talking gibberish. He smiled, waved, and walked away. There were some people you would never click with, no matter how many times you tried, no matter how many shared experiences came your way, and maybe Morrow was one of those. But it didn't matter. As the USIC interviewers had reminded him at every opportunity, he wasn't here for her.